Major funding for NJ Spotlight News is provided in part by NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years, and by the PSCG Foundation.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, an emotional Tammy Murphy resets after dropping out of the U.S. Senate race.
I feel the burden of all those who believe that we can get to a better place.
Refocusing her efforts as First Lady on improving maternal health here in the state.
This work is going to carry on for our state and be a beacon of hope for the rest of the country.
Plus, 1 year in, Patterson officials criticize the state's takeover of their police force.
This takeover is unlawful, it's undemocratic, and quite frankly, it's un-American.
Also, it's official. If you plan to drive into Midtown Manhattan come June, you'll be paying the price. And The Change Project, our new digital series, shines a spotlight on the state's food pantries and their efforts to combat food insecurity amid a rise in hunger.
People are having trouble affording food. It reminds me of something that I heard from a former food bank executive who said, rent eats first.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Wednesday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. First Lady Tammy Murphy is turning the page on what became a heated battle in the Democratic U.S. Senate primary, today making her first public appearance since suspending her campaign and resetting her focus on an issue she made a cornerstone of her husband, Governor Murphy's administration. Maternal health, kicking off the first meeting of the new Maternal and Infant Health Innovation Authority Board, the first of its kind in the nation, a group that'll continue the work of the Nurture NJ program Murphy launched when she became First Lady to ensure new moms have the resources they need to support their families and improve maternal mortality rates that were embarrassingly high for years in the Garden State. When asked about her ending the Senate bid, Murphy today called for party unity and said despite the knockdown, drag-out campaign cycle, she'd do it all again. Senior correspondent Joanna Gagas reports.
Today's board meeting marks the culmination of years of work by countless individuals who have dedicated themselves to improving maternal health across the state.
First Lady Tammy Murphy made her first public appearance today after her announcement this weekend that she's ending her race for the U.S. Senate. Cushioning the landing was a critical step forward today in her maternal health campaign, the first board meeting of the Maternal and Infant Health Innovation Authority, or MIA.
It is going to ensure our state continues to lead the nation as a safe harbor for mothers and babies.
Murphy surprised many in the room, including the newly appointed MIA president and CEO, Lisa Asari, who she was addressing when she dropped this news.
Not only will you be heading the new Maternal Health Authority, but you will also be a newly appointed member of Governor Murphy's cabinet.
MIA has been established to really tell the maternal and infant health story.
A story that saw New Jersey ranked 47th at the start of the Murphy administration, with black moms 7 times more likely to die from childbirth than white moms, and black babies 3 times more likely to die before their first birthday than white babies. But since the launch of Nurture NJ, New Jersey's climbed to 27th.
But not just to tell the story, but to more importantly interface with the whole of government and community to identify solutions. We have a lot of work to do. We want to get maternal health integrated into all health policies. So we talk about health in all policies, but we need to talk about maternal and infant health in all policies.
I now know that this work is going to carry on for our state and be a beacon of hope for the rest of the country.
What won't carry on? Murphy's challenge against Congressman Andy Kim for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate. Murphy says dropping out was not an indication that she couldn't win.
My path to winning the Senate race was crystal clear. Once I realized what a bloody, expensive, and just divisive path I was going to have to go down, I then realized, okay, it's got to be now.
That's likely because Andy Kim and Tammy Murphy were neck and neck in competing for county lines in the state, even as Kim pursues a court battle to abolish the line. Asked about that, Murphy said,
"You all have been incredibly focused on process. I have spent since day number one talking about policy."
But process in New Jersey gets people elected. Is the party line fair?
I'm not smart enough to tell you what needs to be changed or how it should be changed. I've said from the beginning, and I will continue to say now, if there are reforms that will make our process better, then by all means, let's see what they are.
But Murphy got emotional today as she thought about all those who've supported her.
I feel the burden of all those who believe that we can get to a better place.
The First Lady was not ready to endorse any of the three remaining candidates today. She said instead her focus is this authority and the work that remains to be done. In Trenton, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
Tammy Murphy's decision to drop out of the race isn't changing Congressman Andy Kim's pursuit to abolish the so-called party line. The lawsuit alleges the use of that ballot design by 19 of the state's 21 counties is unconstitutional, and a federal judge could issue a preliminary injunction in the case any day, even though Kim now has a clear path to the Democratic nomination, holding the majority of those county party endorsements, putting him in a politically awkward situation. Senior political correspondent David Cruz has the story.
The ground is still trembling a little bit after Tammy Murphy's announcement that she was dropping out of the U.S. Senate primary. But it could all give way as early as this week if the judge in the federal lawsuit to abolish the line makes a ruling.
Andy Kim is now suing for ballot positions that he's got. And he's suing for being excluded from a line that he's now on.
Talk about having your cake and eating it too. It's like the guy in the movie said, if you win, you win. If you lose, you still win. Kim told reporters on Sunday, that may be the case, but the game is the game.
If I don't take lines, it gives my competitors an advantage. And, you know, that's just, you know, the system as it is. So I feel, you know, as I said, like, you know, this is not a system I want to participate in. I think it's unfair, and that's why I'm trying to change it. But, you know, if we're all being forced to operate within the system, if I'm not taking this, there's always that risk in that kind of capacity that, you know, someone else will get an advantage.
Which some have now pointed out sounds a lot like something someone else said to loud groans not too long ago.
We're all competing with the same rules. And, you know, I think that if the rules change and we have reform, that's one thing. But for right now, we're all in the same boat together.
Patricia Campos Medina and Larry Hamm have both won a place on the June ballot. Neither, however, has won a county convention or a county line. They're calling on Kim to be as good as his word when it comes to the party line that he's suing to abolish and that voters should pay attention.
For him to be using the same talking points that Tammy Murphy was using, that she was playing by the rules and those were the rules and she was following the rules, that is, and I always said, those rules don't work for regular people and for working women like me. So for him to use the same talking points is actually accepting a system that works against democracy and works against women of color and it works against Latinas. And it is a moment for him to define what type of leader he's going to be in New Jersey.
Kim is at this crossroads now. This will probably be one of a number of critical tests that he will face.
Kim accepted the line in another bit of irony on a private phone call Sunday with political bosses from some of the state's largest county machines. Lawyers for the defendants in this case say Kim accepting the line means the case has basically settled itself, and that there is no need for injunctive relief. But there are two other plaintiffs here, including Sarah Schoengood, and she begs to differ. She's running in the 3rd District Democratic primary to succeed Andy Kim. She's the kind of longtime resident and small business owner ballot reform is supposed to encourage.
This lawsuit is not just about one person. It's not just about Andy Kim. It's not just about me. It's not just about the other plaintiff. This is about having a fair ballot in New Jersey for all future people who want to run. All people are asking for is to have a fair place on the ballot. So it'll allow people who meet me, who hear my name, to see it and be like, oh, I met her. That's who I like her. I want to vote for her, instead of having to scan the entire ballot, which most people don't do.
The judge has given both sides until the end of the day to chime in on what impact Murphy's departure should have on his ruling, which could come as early as this week. At that point, candidates may finally find themselves being judged by the content of their character and not their position on the party line. I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
Today marks 1 year since the state took control of all law enforcement functions within Patterson's police department, which followed years of police misconduct and evidence of excessive use of force. Since then, the state has touted a drop in violent crime, more discipline for officers who misbehave, and more public input through an increased number of community meetings. Yet top leaders in the city are pushing back on that narrative and say much of the improvement can actually be traced to reform that were already in place. Melissa Rose Cooper has the update.
I've seen a stronger connection and communication between the community and the police department, far better than it was in the past.
A major change, community advisor Corey Teague says, has happened in the last year since the state took control of the Patterson Police Department. State Attorney General Matthew Plackin making the announcement a year ago today, just weeks after the death of Najee Seabrooks during a mental health crisis following a 4 hours plus standoff with police. The AG saying Seabrooks' death, along with other incidents of police misconduct, created a crisis of confidence in Patterson.
And it's important because in the past, there was not a strong connection between the community and the police department at all. They did have community policing for years in Patterson, but for some reason, I'm not sure exactly why the connection wasn't there. But in the past year, it's been a tremendous effort by the police department and, you know, equally by the community to bridge that gap.
Last fall, NYPD Chief of Strategic Initiatives Issa Abbasi, whom Plackin appointed as officer in charge of the Patterson Police Department, outlined a strategic plan of reform. The initiative included having more visible officers in the community, as well as increased transparency. The Attorney General commending Abbasi's leadership, saying in a statement, 1 year later, we are seeing significant progress in many areas, including police accountability, transparency, communication, and a significant drop in violent crime. But not everyone agrees.
I'm going to contend that Matt Plackin, this takeover, is unlawful, it's undemocratic, and quite frankly, it's un-American. The Attorney General can't make the law, fake the law, or break the law.
Mayor Andre Saia credits a reduction in crime and improved relationships between law enforcement and the community to programs the city was already working on.
We've created an opioid response team. We have a Real Fix program to address opioid use disorder. So those two work in concert with each other. We have a guaranteed income initiative to help or empower the working poor. We have a financial empowerment center, which I believe is helping individuals who've been struggling for far too long.
The mayor is now part of a lawsuit challenging the state's takeover of the police department. Saia accuses Plackin of wanting to advance his own political career. He argues Plackin's programs mimic some of the programs already in place in Patterson, and he criticized the attorney general for, quote, exiling the police chief to a training program while taxpayers still pay his salary. In response to critics, Plackin says it is regrettable that some public officials can only view bold actions through the lens of ambition. Here, we took bold action simply because it was the right thing to do. My office has a long-term commitment to the people of Patterson, and our work in the city is far from complete.
You know, the place that we ended up in, it didn't happen overnight, and, you know, the road to recovery restoring the relationship between the police department and the city, that's not going to take overnight either. That's going to take a little while. It's a process.
And while community advocates agree there's still plenty of room for improvement, they're hopeful they can continue to work with the city and law enforcement to continue to improve community police relations. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Alyssa Rose Cooper.
Well, that controversial congestion pricing plan for New York City is a go. Today, getting the official green light from the Metropolitan Transportation Authority Board to charge a new $15 toll for passenger cars driving into the heart of Manhattan, making it the first city in the nation to adopt congestion pricing aimed at reducing traffic and pollution and to raise about $1 billion a year for New York's public transit system. But will a pending federal lawsuit brought by groups from this side of the river stop it in its tracks? Ted Goldberg reports.
Congestion pricing has been approved and will start affecting New Jersey drivers in mid-June unless a lawsuit stops it in its tracks.
The more exemptions, the higher the base toll, and we wanted to keep the base toll as low as we possibly could. The more exemptions that we grant, the more, or recommend, the more people who don't get exemptions feel that they were left out.
The MTA voted to approve congestion pricing today with few exemptions and only a $5 discount for New Jerseyans entering Manhattan through the Lincoln and Holland tunnels. They heard an earful from people before voting to authorize a $15 charge for cars entering Manhattan at or below 60th Street for most of the day.
This is the day that the MTA has officially said to the yellow cab industry that you do not have a right to exist on the streets of New York City.
The MTA argues congestion pricing is necessary to reduce traffic, help the environment, and make more stations accessible. But New Jersey leaders were furious, with some even mentioning the dreaded B word.
The emergency vehicles that can't get through, I mean, we lived that through, Chris Christie and Bridgegate. I don't want to live that again.
New Jersey is suing to prevent congestion pricing, and Bergen County has signed on. County Executive Jim Tedesco says the MTA should have waited to implement congestion pricing until the lawsuit was resolved.
This is just rushing it through where they didn't have to do that. They've got a date in their mind, and they said to hell with everybody else.
They are the worst run mass transit system in the entire nation. They're bleeding billions of dollars a year, and they're looking for anyone to pay their help pay their bills for their complete mismanagement.
Count Congressman Josh Gottheimer as another leader angry about congestion pricing.
It's going to lead to more truck traffic at the GW Bridge. They admitted to that. Cancer-causing pollution will be pluming into northern New Jersey.
The GWB is in his district. Gottheimer says traffic will get a lot worse on the world's busiest bridge unless public support makes the MTA change its mind, or that lawsuit is successful.
They obviously don't care about other people. They don't care about people who've got to work hard to try to make ends meet. They don't care about the nurse or the small business.
But not everybody was furious after today's vote.
In order to reduce traffic, you have to have fewer number of trips, right? So yes, it's incentivizing people to use public transit, to walk, to bike when they can.
Kate Slevin is the executive vice president of the Regional Plan Association, and she hopes congestion pricing will lead to more people using mass transit. While not everybody can use mass transit to get where they need to go, Slevin hopes state and federal governments take this opportunity to invest in mass transit.
We're very much in support of additional transit funding across the board. Investing in the core of the system is really important for the future of our region.
For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Ted Goldberg.
In our Spotlight on Business report, a look at the economic ripple effects of the tragic Baltimore Bridge collapse. The government and supply chain experts are warning of regional consequences after the Port of Baltimore was effectively blocked by the shocking collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The central span was destroyed after a fully loaded cargo ship apparently lost power and collided with its support early Tuesday morning. Six construction workers who had been on the bridge at that time time are still missing and presumed dead. Two others were rescued from the water. Vessel traffic in and out of Baltimore is now suspended indefinitely, creating new headaches for the shipping industry, which is also being hampered by conflict in the Middle East and problems at the Panama Canal. Baltimore is the nation's largest port for importing and exporting cars. It's also a key point for shipping machinery, coal, and construction supplies. Traffic in and out of Baltimore is now being redirected to other East Coast ports, including those in New Jersey.
At the end of the day, there is a potential for not just capacity, but also expertise to be shifted over, to be imported to New Jersey. It's going to take a little while, though, because these things do need to be planned out.
On Wall Street, stocks rebounded today after a losing session. Here's today's closing trading numbers. And finally tonight, we launch the next installment in our digital project, the Change Series, where we focus on possible solutions to some of the state's most pressing social and economic challenges. Food insecurity isn't a new problem in New Jersey, but the demand for assistance has grown, and meeting the need goes far beyond just access to food pantries. Connections need to be established with clients to not only help them put food on the table, but address their larger needs. Contributing writer John Hurdle joins me now for a look at how agencies are trying to adapt while also improve services. John, it's so good to have you in the studio. What an excellent piece you did. I'm so curious why demand is still so high, though we are removed from the public health crisis of the pandemic.
The short answer is food, high food prices. And what I've been hearing from a lot of people in the food aid system, whether they be food banks or food pantries or government agencies, is that people are having trouble affording food. And it reminds me of something that I heard from a former food bank executive who said, rent eats first. So people often have to make a choice between whether they're going to pay their insurance bills or whether they're going to pay their rent or whether they're going to pay their car payments, whatever. And in some cases, they are turning to food banks because there is a free source of food there.
Well, sure, because it's not just food, it's consumer prices overall we have seen grown, and that money has to get distributed throughout. So how many people are we talking in New Jersey who are in need and who are right now established to get it?
Well, what the state says is that there are approximately 800,000 New Jerseyans who are recipients of SNAP. That is the federal program that used to be called food stamps. That was kind of a revelation to me in the course of reporting this story, is that there are really that many people who are food insecure. These are people who don't necessarily have consistent access to healthy food, and that is the definition of food insecurity.
Consistent access.
Consistent
That's the
access.
Key there.
Correct.
And so folks who are in, say, a food desert, they may be more prone to being included in this list. What is the state doing, and how are food pantries stepping up?
Well, food pantries are stepping up in a number of ways. One is that they are distributing more fresh produce, more fruits and vegetables. And now that's been going on for a while, and that preceded the pandemic. But what the food pantry executives will tell you is that this is an attempt to persuade their clients to eat more fruits and vegetables because for the simple reason that they are it's better for them. It tends to reduce the likelihood of illnesses like obesity and high blood pressure, heart disease, and so on, which may come with eating lots of processed foods. So that's one of the ways in which the food banks are stepping up.
But clearly there is a need, and so is the state designating more money if we're talking about almost a million residents who are eligible or receiving SNAP benefits? How is the state looking to solve this food insecurity crisis?
Well, one of the ways that the state is stepping up is by the legislature voting more money to deal with food insecurity. The governor's budget for the coming fiscal year. Of course, this is just a proposal, but he's planning to spend around about $100 million on food insecurity, and this is up from $85 million in the current fiscal year.
And are these food banks and pantries, are they coordinating their efforts? Because we have so much more data at our fingertips now to pinpoint folks. Are they using that?
Yes, they certainly are. And what I'm hearing is that food banks are using data to identify sources of food need, such as poverty, unemployment, immigration, and so if they identify that things like that are noticeable in a particular area, then they will concentrate their efforts in that area.
That opens the door for them to lead them to other services. John Hertel, you can check out his Change Series piece on our website, njspotlightnews.org. So good to see you.
You're welcome.
And that does it for us tonight. But don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Brianna Venosi. For the entire NJ Spotlight News team, thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. And RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.